Earlier this week, I made my very first trip to the National Crate Blacks and Wax Museum on the 1600 block of East North Avenue. And I'd seen their stuff before when they first opened in 83 with a traveling tour, but I never really walked through this museum. And I was lucky enough to meet its co-founder there and president and CEO, Dr. Joanne Martin. She founded the museum with her late husband, Elmer. We started walking through the museum and began by walking down these stairs into the slavery exhibit, depicting the horrific conditions that African people endured on slave ships. You felt it. It just surrounded you. And here's Dr. Martin.
I tell people when you're going through the museum, it's like you're walking around in the head of my late husband, Dr. Elmer Martin.
Right.
He was our visionary. Research all over the world, went to Liverpool and lived at the Library of Congress, and we wanted to see how other immigrant groups told their story. So going to Ellis Island or the Cherokee Museum in North Carolina, just learning as much as we can about telling the story of immigrant groups.
Oh, I see you've got this kind of this condition of young men in the slave ship. This is the literal narrative you built it from.
Yes, because the three prime group of slaves were, of course, the male slaves.
Right.
And then the female slaves. And they were often, because our slave ship is generic. There was no, we didn't want to it to be the Amistad or whatever. but that some of the conditions fit different ships, but often the women were housed right underneath the captain and the crew. So they had ready access through a ladder. To the women, and that also was led to many of the mutinies, because these men were shackled. They saw themselves, you know, they powerless to do anything about the brutality of the women who were separated. Young boys aged 6 to 11 were highly prized. Take a 6-year-old, you've got a long time to turn him into what you need him to be psychologically, and so they were also the boys' quarters represented them. Captives aged 12 to 30 were for the men's quarters.
And I was just looking at the women. I mean, so you have this wax figure of a white sailor, slaver, in the women's quarters,
right.
On purpose.
Purpose, yes. Yeah. That was the reason for the ladder that gave them ready access to the women.
Yeah, first thing I thought of when looking at these, because, you know, you see so much in the museums and exhibits about the Holocaust in Europe, and you see how people are slammed together inside the camps. This is the same, if not worse, feel you see here when you have these things of feet and head just close together, sticking out.
Exactly. And they, there were two philosophies. That's why I'm saying that we don't tell any one aspect of this, but the loose packing philosophy and the tight packing philosophy, and all of them around the idea that there's so much disease and vermin and smallpox and all kind of horrors on the ship. One, that most of them are going to die. Pack them together as closely as you can so that you can get more onto the ship and therefore make a bigger profit when they come up for auction.
The effect of this is pretty stunning. I've always been curious who, I know you said your husband studied and made this historically correct. Who made the figures literally?
Meant the figures in here were made by my husband and his team. But the wax figures that you see, the wax figures really represent, for me, the evolution of the museum, because the ones that you saw early on represent the beginning. We have another some that are 100% beeswax that represent the middle years. We have the President Obama and Mary McLeod Bethune and so forth that represent another ever part of our evolution, and then we have Freeman Hrabowski, who is the newer figure, and you know, and I won't say any more than that until you see him. But so that again, the evolution of the museum through the techniques and the changing techniques of the wax figures.
These are very powerful. What are these made of?
These are reconstructed mannequins. Some of them, in many cases, my husband and his team would have taken probably a white mannequin and given it the features that turned him into a little African-American boy. And since people are so close, then that also here, it means that they're less likely to get broken, because that's a real problem with our museum, because so much of our history has been kept away from us. And to deny access to people is something that we kind of fight against. So the figures are close to you, but that creates another kind of problem.
Very powerful.
we are a museum with a message. And a part of that, I do a presentation to kids where I talk to them about the frightening similarities between the slave ship and the penitentiary, where in both cases you're taken away in chains or given a number or branded, in one case a slave and in the other case a criminal, made property of the slave master of the state, and in both cases confined. I talk to kids about that their ancestors would know a slave trader if they saw one, but might be confused today by the ones we call drug dealers, who create another kind of slavery, very much tying it to the past and the present, which was a part of my husband's philosophy. He said that if we're going to continue to tell our children that they should have an appreciation of the struggle and an understanding of the struggle, we need to give them yardsticks by which to measure the struggle. And for them, they think the struggle has to do with sitting on the back of the bus where today they want to sit, and not understand that Rosa Parks lived at a time when she could have been lynched for that act. So that kind of context is missing, and where we dropped the ball, decided that we weren't going to burden them with any of that, and then suddenly we wanted them to be able to make a connection with their grandmother, with their history, and they wanted none of it. So having to go back and start all over, just in helping them to make those connections. Or that any child, I had two white students who came with a group from Baltimore County or someplace, but one of them asked me, why do we need to know this? And I was truly glad that he asked me that question. I said, you know, the majority of the group is made up of white students, but there are some African Americans and some Latinos maybe. But for all of you, you will likely be in a position to determine policy, to determine laws, to determine eligibility for programs, to shape minds as teachers. And you can only do that effectively if you have if you can have a respect for all of the ways that we as human beings came together to create a world, bad or good, by taking the time to learn the individual stories of people like what you're doing here today. For me, gives me the confidence that you can be a better policymaker or lawmaker or teacher or whatever it is you become, or parent.
Good answer. Yeah. This is a pretty profound sight. I mean, from toilet conditions to women to refuse slaves that were throwaways, the woman hanging by a chain.
And this is from an article in National Geographic about the punishment of the rebellious slaves in this particular incident with her. Because, you know, they didn't go gently into that night. They were looking for weaknesses with the captain and the crew so that they could rebel. They were looking for any opportunity to run away. And they fought. They and that might be throwing yourself overboard or throwing your child overboard because you didn't want them to live in those kind of conditions. So they defined resistance in many ways. We have we get groups who call and they ask for a guided tour. We also have an audio tour. The state aided institution grant. We have about a $47,000 grant from that program, and so we either offer a huge discount or, for some Title I schools, they come in free, and for every one of them, whatever discount or whatever, they get the guided tour.
So we are now in
ancient Africa, and we're trying very hard to expand. And so you see this, all of this before what you just saw, Queen Anne Nzinga, for example, and her efforts to save the captives, to keep Africa free, invited other African nations that they were trying to escape the slave trade to come to Angola, and she and her army would protect them.
Famous.
Yes.
Nzinga.
Yes.
Your new books, you had old books, when the white school finished with them, you might have to take them, and so on.
This was when we unveiled President Obama's figure in 2009, the day before the inauguration, the first inauguration. And I simply didn't want this to be about President Obama. And I told the group, I'm sure President Obama would understand that, but about those people who laid the way for President Obama to be able to become President of the United States. So,
Karen Mitchell, is that right?
Yes. 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 And his brother Clarence. Mary McLeod Bethune, we had another Mary McLeod Bethune, but we just unveiled this in April at Morgan. And we have Thurgood Marshall, of course, who was appointed first by President Kennedy and then for the Supreme Court by President Johnson. So all of them, but also this group of that coming out of slavery, that the vote was important. And so much so that we were able to elect that freshman class of congresspersons or to occupy state governments and so forth, or the ways in which education, most of the historically black colleges and universities that came into being that period after slavery up to about 1910. And a person like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, who went to the mat as Republicans to fight for public education, for newly freed slaves, but also just children in America, the right to have a public education.
And there he is.
Yes,
Dr. Freeman Hrabowski.
When he stood there, because this is the way, I mean, if you watch him, that's the way he holds his hands, and so much of the nuance of the smile and everything, that's just him. And that's another, you know, that's a part of the evolution. I try to control, as my husband did, the process. And the whole idea that a sculptor controls the process, so I'm always looking for sculptors, I'm looking for emerging sculptors, and it's a very, the whole process is very involved. So you have hair weavers and skin color specialists and a master sculptor on every team and the costumer and all of those things. So that for me is the process. And
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's because you give work to lots of different people.
Yes.
Artists to kind of help create this.
Exactly.
It's a great expression for Perrin. PJ looked like that, didn't he?
Yes. He really did, and he used to come in all the time. He was here for the unveiling, and he would show up. We have a figure of Osborne Payne as well, and his some kids were here one day, and he was here standing looking at his figure because he'd come in every week and change his clothes, or maybe five.
You had the footsteps leading, walking in the footsteps of our ancestors, with the literal footsteps walking through Walter White, Whitney Young, Fannie Lou Hamer, Dorothy Height, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Jesse Jackson, countless others.
Yes. And then looking at some of the very troubling statistics that 26.5% of African Americans live below the poverty line at the time that we did this, and I know that those statistics are probably even worse. But my husband's message from the ancestors, this is one of the things. And that was a technique of his, like we start here and go back in time and let the ancestors speak. And he does that at different places in the museum. We did not struggle to keep our minds from being shackled, only to have you turn away from learning and the wise ways of the elders. We did not endure bondage for you to become a slave to drugs and alcohol. We did not die by the millions for you to kill one another by the thousands. We did not ward off their insults and claims of our inferiority for you to hate yourself. We did not become their human commodity, their black ivory, their black gold, for you to put material things over your people, even your own families and children. We withstood their slaughterhouse slave ships, their seasoning and breaking, for you to walk in unity and live with dignity. And that's pure Elmer Martin.
That we will not die by the millions for you to kill one another by the thousands. Mm-hmm. Someone said that the other day on the show. That quote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had no idea what your husband's
quote.
Yes,
right. Well, give him his props.
I will from now on. I'll always get his props.
Yes. We average about 10,000 to 12,000 people for Black History Month. And our busiest month of the year is July. And we do, our visitors come between February and Labor Day. And then it becomes a wasteland. Very scary, but you know, lots of school children on the weekends, a lot of mentoring groups, so adults bringing children from, and 65% of our visitors come from out of state. So, and that's what has kept us alive for the 30 years. 2013 was our 30th year as a museum. It started before that with the traveling exhibit, where you would see my husband and me carrying these figures and setting them up and
right.
Yeah, coming back and getting them and taking home to our two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. all lived together for
a while.
Yes,
yes, we did. Mary McLeod Bethune. Our first four were Mary McLeod Bethune, Frederick Douglass, John Brown, and George Washington Carver. And then closely followed by Harriet Tubman and some others. The museum, for me, is divided into two themes. What is this thing called slavery? And what is this thing called freedom? And so this side of the museum is the what is this thing called slavery. The other side of the museum is, because it's like a horseshoe, what is this thing called freedom?
Okay, so right across from one another.
Right. With this idea of what is this thing called slavery, you have someone like a Harriet Tubman who thought that it meant service in the Underground Railroad. She's here with Thomas Garrett, who worked with her in that effort. He said that he always grabbed his pocketbook whenever Harriet came because he knew they was going to have to give up some money, but he worked, you know, just tooth and nail with her in her effort to free slaves. Or it might be these people who thought that because it was such an evil that it had to be fought through violent means. And so a John Brown or a Toussaint Louverture or Nat Turner who did believe that it had to be fought the way you'd fight any evil. Or for some of them it meant religion. And fighting it through the churches and through a belief in God, or through the courts, as with the Dred Scott, or through the oratory with the Sojourn of Truth and Frederick Douglass further down.
The price of freedom.
The lynching exhibit is downstairs. When the Senate made an apology for the U.S. Senate made an apology for not passing anti-lynching laws. They sent us the resolution. We have a wax figure of Walter White. This is him, and we talk about his work with Charles Hamilton Houston in laying the strategy for how the civil rights movement, how the NAACP would fight segregation, and coming up with what eventually led to the Brown versus Board of Education. And we really want and must have a figure of Charles Hamilton Houston because he was so key to history itself. I guess the three people, if someone said, we'll give you the money today, what three people? It would be Charles Hamilton Houston, Bayard Rustin, and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Those are the next three you'd like to do.
That's the three I'd like to do.
So when you say if you had the money, what does that mean? How much does it cost to do that?
We are talking anywhere, and it could depend. If we were talking about a dancer like Josephine Baker, and if she was going to be in her little banana costume and all of her legs and most of her body was going to be shown, then we could be talking $90,000, $100,000 for one figure. Average, we're talking anywhere from $30,000 to $50,000, just for the ones that are here. Now, so it's very expensive. It's very specialized art, and we're talking about something that's going to be around, we hope, forever. Ida B. Wells, the journalist, you know, through her Red Record and other publications, would print the names of perpetrators of lynching, had to run out of Memphis by night when her newspaper office was bombed and burned to the ground. And as soon as she got set up in New York again, she started doing those same things. So, very courageous woman. Many people don't know that what Rosa Parks did with the bus, Ida B. Wells did decades before on the train.
Maybe we don't know the history at all, because it wasn't made important. It's only becoming important now. People
exactly.
are now being
exactly.
right.
Exactly. From 100 years, the book 100. Years of lynching, 5,000 names of known lynch victims. People used to come, and almost like the Vietnam Memorial, come and look for names family members. And Florida, my state of Florida, leads the list. Of course, the story of Emmett Till.
Yeah.
And the courageousness of his mother, Mamie. And that, you know, was something that you definitely emphasized. And kids are often surprised to see little kids at a lynching, and they comment on that. And these little kids look as if they'd been in Sunday school at morning, and then at dusk, there they are, just witnessing that horror. There was a superstition about the Lynch wrote, so it was supposed to have 13 knots. If the crime itself wasn't, you weren't unlucky enough to be a victim of the crime, but you had to have some symbol of that. And they would take trophies, so you might go into find upstanding citizen's house and find a usher badge or something, or some medal, and an eyeball. That was a very common occurrence. But
you're listening to our visit to an underappreciated gem right here in our own backyard, Baltimore's own National Great Blacks in Wax Museum. And we're speaking with Dr. Joanne Martin, the museum's co-founder, president, and CEO. There's more to our tour through the incredibly informative museum, and more right after this break. On our way to the break, we're going to hear Baltimore's own Philip Glass, cousin of Ira Glass, but one of the great composers, minimalist composers in America. You're hearing now Einstein on the Beach. He was born on this day in 1937. Incredible composer. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that was Public Image by Public Image Limited, fronted by John Lydon, who was born on this day in 1956. We continue our journey to the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum, located on the east end of North Avenue here in Baltimore. And the museum's co-founder, president, and CEO, Dr. Joanne Martin, showed us around and talked about the museum's plan to transform itself into an anchor in an often neglected part of our community in East Baltimore.
This exhibit is "And a Little Child Shall Lead Them, Black Youth in the Struggle." So we talk about the ways that children have been called upon throughout history and throughout the world to fight against slavery, oppression, injustice. So we've got, you know, this little child from Maryland who lost his arms and legs to frostbite, but he managed to escape slavery even without arms and legs. Or the little boy on the woodpile who was playing one day with some kids, some little white kids, some little black kids. A little white girl leaned over and kissed him on the cheeks, and some white adults, males, got so upset about this, they were talking about burning him alive. And another white man in the group talked them out of that, saying, "This is a child, you know, well, how could you dare even consider?" So they backed off of that, but he managed to escape. Reason prevailed. Or the Scottsboro boys, or the youth, the white youth and black youth there at the lunch counters, you know, being brutalized in right. Sit-ins, yes. Or children out there on the front line of battle during the civil rights movement who had to withstand the water hoses and the billy clubs and all of that. Or going back to the slave ship and the idea that these were the barracoons. These are the slave pens, and these were children who had been stolen from their village, and they would be placed in, because they often were separated. The women were separated from the men, and the children were separated from the adults. But on the way to the slave fort, they would be held when they stopped overnight or whatever. They would be held in the slave pens at the slave port slave fort itself. They might be held in the slave pens, and here they were coming up for auction.
Is this a montage was created, or are these actual children who were
actual children who were held? Well, the four little girls from the church bombing, or children of South Africa, showing that apartheid very much akin to segregation and in fact, much more brutal in many ways. And these crosses representing black-on-black crime that in 1994, when we unveiled this exhibit, 321 of the 326 young people who died, the majority of them below, younger than 25 years old, but the majority of them died as a result of black-on-black crime.
You know, a lot of, when you have these exhibits, the different fraternities and sororities, I think there are a lot of young people, especially in poor communities, who don't have an idea about what these meant, what these organizations meant, where they were founded. They weren't like just the fraternities founded on most campuses, white campuses. This was a kind of a profound social growth statement.
Exactly. And those are the kinds of stories that as we worked very hard to expand the museum. I mean, we ran out of space long ago, but there's still, even within our space, there's a lot of history here, And those stories like Cecil B. Moore, called the Lion of North Philly, you know, and his fight as a civil rights champion, that we know the ways in which people had to fight and why they were fighting or what they were fighting for. I put kids mentally on a bus and say, okay, we're in Wilson, North Carolina, and it's you've been on the bus for all morning since 6 o'clock this morning, and it's now 11, and they talk about wanting to get some food and wanting to go to the bathroom. Are we going to go to McDonald's? It's 1954 or 52 or 46 or whatever, and getting them to understand that that wasn't you weren't going to just jump off the bus and run to a McDonald's, and that if you depending on a certain time of day, you didn't want to be in some areas. You wanted to make sure that your bus didn't break down in certain places. And just having to be cognizant of that. When you planned a trip, it wasn't simply let's get in the car and go to grandma's. Those are the kinds of things, again, those yardsticks that my husband Elmer talked about.
This is an important character, people, just the idea of black entrepreneurs and leaders in the early part of the 20th century are important to kind of bring out here.
Yes. We were given by a family here in Baltimore, one of their relatives invented the permanent wave machine for Madam C.J. Walker. So we have that authentic permanent wave machine. Yes. And hers is a very interesting history, that she was losing her hair, and that's how she really started she found products, natural products, and you know, making that kind of connection to kids, how important the importance we place on natural products today. And that's what she did, just in some olive oil and all kinds of things that she found naturally in her natural world. And it started to grow her hair back. And she said, aha, because there were any number of black women who were losing their hair. And so she started putting them in little probably mayonnaise jars or something and selling them. And a woman definitely ahead of her time, using the natural products, selling door to door, creating this group of women in the same way that Avon and Mary Kay did, of women who then began selling door to door, the direct sale technique.
I'm just keep thinking about what it takes to keep this going and expanding it. And
because we are one of the many people don't know that we're not a publicly funded museum, which is to my consternation. And so every visitor, when my husband and I started this, we knew that in your own backyard, you might not put as much importance on it. So people always feel like, I can get here anytime because I'm from Baltimore. Often the visitors who come from Baltimore come because they have brought someone who's from New York or someplace that said, well, I know we're going to the Great Blacks and Wax Museum. And it is that out-of-state visitorship that has kept us alive here 30 years later, because we've gotten capital funds from the city and the state to be able to expand, but we do not get operating funds, and that is a major challenge, and we're working very hard to correct that. I shake my head even now that we are still here.
Yeah, I mean, because you don't have the endowment power that a lot of other older institutions, mostly white institutions, have in this community.
Exactly.
This is a lot about the legacy and root of wealth.
In health, let's look at Dr. Rebecca Lee Crummer. And the first graduate nurse, Mary.
What is this thing called freedom? This side, and the second slavery that sharecropping was emphasized there, but also education as freedom, and
George Washington Carver
joining unions as freedom, using your creative genius as freedom. So that the inventors like George Washington Carver, your good friend George Washington Carver, and Charles Drew and Lewis Latimer and Granville T. Woods up there on the pole.
Yeah, these were kind of critical things in science and the inventions that were made that, again, you know, the more, like, we're going to do a day in history on the show, like, I never heard of Purvis before this who invented the fountain pen. Nobody knows that a black man invented the fountain pen. Oh, Baltimoreans, Howard Rawlins. Paul Robeson spent a lot of time in Baltimore.
Everything you
see here. Billie Holiday.
Philadelphia and New York want to claim her, but she was born here.
And this is your African freedom leaders?
We have Nelson. Many people asked, you know, they were coming looking for the little grandfather, the gray-haired Nelson Mandela, when he died, and then all of us, and because we've had his figure since 1988. And for me, if we're going to not want to look at the grandfatherly Nelson Mandela because that's a figure that we find him safe and want to run away from the one that was in prison and run away from and not ask the questions of what led him to be in prison to begin with, what were the conditions in South Africa that made his imprisonment necessary, then we will not be doing the grandfatherly Nelson Mandela. So for me, this Nelson Mandela and is just as important to who he is as the one that people feel comfortable with. Yeah. And so I'm willing to have both, but certainly not just have the older one, the one who that people are comfortable with, versus the one who's here.
Haile Selassie.
And we have the figure of Bob Marley here. My husband Elmer sculpted that. And because we want kids to make the connection. He was born Tafari, and Ras meaning prince, so therefore Rastafari, or Rastafarians, that's why consider him to be their spiritual leader, and use taking his name to create theirs. So we do the men of the civil rights movement and the women.
It's funny seeing people there who are alive.
Yes. We have to tell kids all the time, you do not have to be dead to get into this museum.
We have on this side Fanny Lou Hamer, Dorothy Height, Mildred Bon Roxborough.
She's still alive and helped to build the membership program for the NAACP. Rosa Parks was here. We have a picture of her standing next to her figure. She came here when she was on her 75th birthday tour.
That's like slave chains?
Yes. Yes.
Can I?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know, we'll give you some.
So there's a human being that was shackled inside of these one day.
Yes.
Once.
Yes. They were made.
These are heavy.
Forged in the 1700s.
These are really heavy.
Yeah.
Can you imagine walking in these? Being forced to walk in these? Ankle bracelets? Arms. This is wrist and neck.
It could be ankle bracelets depending on the length of the chain.
Right. This was your neck. This was around your neck.
Right.
Feel the weight of that.
We heard about the auction of slave artifacts, and we had $147, and he wanted the chains. He didn't know what his $147 was going to buy, and it got down to him and another young African American woman. He would bid, and they started bidding $2, a piece between them. And he saw that they had gotten down to about $143, and so he knew that he wasn't going to last much longer. And he went over to her and asked her what was she going to do with the chains. And she said, "I have a private collection. I'm going to put it in with my collection." And he said, "Well, that's that's all well and good, but I'm from a museum, and with your having them, a limited number of people will see them. If you let me get them, then that means that any number of people will get them, and they can be a teaching tool and reach a larger audience." And so she just kind of shrugged. She didn't say one way or another, but when they went back to the bidding, she just remained silent and allowed him to have them. And they're a very important part of what we do in talking to kids about those frightening connections between the slave ship and the penitentiary, or Elmer's "We Didn't Die by the Millions for You to Kill One Another by the Thousands."
How old these are?
They are about 300 years old.
That old?
Yes. It's really disheartening to look at the homicides that take place and the many, many kids that we lose, or the emphasis they place on clothing and some things that in the grand scheme of things aren't worth it, but you're willing to take a life for it. And that if you could look at the way your ancestors clung to life when the option might have been to just go ahead and die, but they fought very hard to cling to life. They fought very hard to learn to read and write. Those things that far too many of our children want to just dismiss. It saddens me when I hear black kids and look at the struggle to get an education, to say that learning is a white thing. That is just so disheartening to me. And so though we are very preachy here, and we don't mind preaching, and sometimes they come in and they're jaded and they leave and they're in tears, or they go down in the slave ship and they're in tears. That does my heart good. It does. I want them to cry. They have used words like transformed to me. That is an amazing just turn around in the way they may have felt when they came in. I can remember that there was a group of young men who had come in with the student of my husband, Elmer's, brought in this group of kids, and they wanted to go to ESPN Zone. And he bribed them. You can only go to ESPN Zone if you come to Great Blacks and Wax. And they were very resentful. They did not, this is the last place they wanted to be. And when they came in, I was talking about, you know, that Elmer and I had made any number of sacrifices and whatever. And I'm talking to them, and one of them said, y'all got all kind of money. Y'all making all kind of money here, ain't you? You know, just kind of interrupted me. And I said, no, my husband and I have made any number of sacrifices to open this museum and keep it open. And so I go back to Bessie Coleman and whatever, and we're in the lobby. And then he says, well, what you do it for then? And I say, we do it for you. We do it because we want you to understand the ways in which people whose blood is flowing through your body right now help to build this country. We do it because we want you to understand how much they fought for you to be able to get an education or to be allowed to go to ESPN Zone. And, you know, just we do it because. And so we went in, and I always knew that there was a place in the museum where I was going to get them. While I was working my way to that place, they weren't paid. They were looking around, talking to one another, being very, very disrespectful. The young man who brought them, he didn't know what to do. But I just kept on talking because I knew that very soon I would be at that place. And so I just, you know, threw my line out. And they were mine. I knew, okay, you belong to me now. And I saw them riveted at what I was talking about. So much so that I figured, well, they are interested. The group leader came and told me they decided they'll go to ESPN Zone tomorrow. They want to stay here today. Those are, for me, the victories, because these young men, somewhere maybe between 21 and 25. They're the ones who may get incarcerated. They're the ones who may die an early death, and for them to decide that it was worth the effort to stay and listen and learn is a true victory for me, and I take my victories where I can find them.
That's right. That's a great story. It's a very powerful place that you all built together. It must be a struggle for you personally, though, to keep it going by yourself, given that you two were such partners.
Exactly. And Elmer was such a genius, so far ahead of his time, and I worry that that I'm up to the task, but I decided that...
The task, so must be sometimes a harder walk because it was the two of you.
Exactly. And, he taught me so much. He was always teaching but never preaching, and that was good. But I also know that that he learned a lot from me. I know that he respected what I brought to his learning. I know that given that he came out of a militant time, was very much the militant, that he could very well have been dead. I remember once that he was talking about sometimes you have to die for your beliefs.
Right.
And I told him, anybody can die. Sometimes it's harder to live for your beliefs than to die for them.
A woman should speak to the man she's with. I told you that it was 25 years ago, whatever that day was. I remember seeing the exhibit when you all traveled with it when I was younger. You know, I've been on the air for 21 years. This may be the first time that you all have been on the show, which is absurd. I mean, I'm sitting here with these chains. I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, when you hold these things and you know that a man had these chains around his neck and his wrists.
I don't see those as artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Alive.
Yeah, absolutely. I say when I think about the fact that my great, 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 whatever, may very well have been right. Held in those, or that, as you just said, a human being, that those held a human being. When I look at just the connection between people, that England in particular, these were often weapons used as a form of religious persecution. and then became, you know, transformed for use in the slavery industry. But, you know, so any of our ancestors could very well have been held by something like that, or that in itself. So,
there's no question about it. My mother was English. I mean, she was a great person. She was a real anti-colonial Brit. She was crazy, mad woman, good woman. I just thought, you know, you're holding these things in your hand. And it's just telling me, well, it's very possible, just possible, that somebody in my mother's family tree worked on one of those ships, just as a seaman or whatever, you know?
That's the dynamic of history, that we have lost so many of the connections, but even more importantly, that we, things that we should see as superficial, that we use to divide us and define us, that in the grand scheme of things, when you look at struggle or overcoming, then that should do more to unite us than it does to separate us. And it takes you away from the museum, but we down at the end of the block is the Bauernschmidt Mansion, built in 1892, 1893, owned by George Bauernschmidt. He was a beer baron. And it was designed by George Frederick, who built and designed Baltimore City Hall. And then in around 1935, it became the George Sander and Son Funeral Home. So there's the history of the Georges with that building.
And what are you going to do with that?
Well, it's a part of it. We own all of the buildings on this block.
You own this whole block?
Yes. And
this block of North Avenue?
Yes, yes. And wow. Working very, very hard to expand. The major drawings we are down at the mansion, but we started acquiring the properties in 1995. My husband, Elmer, and I started acquiring the properties. This is the mansion that I mentioned to you, and this is the firehouse or museum where we are now. And the museum, the current museum, would be the children's museum. So most of the exhibits would take place here, starting over 250,000 years ago, when man stepped out onto the continent of Africa and evolved as man, and that history that ties all of us together with that African mother in Africa, and then coming up to modern times and dividing it into galleries. So the gallery of spirituality and religion, and where one of the exhibits would be the making of the African American community and the church's role in that. Anyway, that's this, and then this will be a space for weddings and so forth.
This is Broadway.
This is Broadway. Right? Yeah. So it's on the corner of Broadway. This is, of course, North Avenue. This will be our new museum, and so that's what keeps me motivated, just trying to carry on the fundraising for this and to create a legacy for our ancestors, but also for my late husband, Elmer. The other, we have one of the drawings, there's one of the spaces is a rooftop garden where you could, from here, you can see all of, into downtown Baltimore, and it's just an amazing space. We hired our architects on the strength of the history and genius of Max Bond. He graduated from the Harvard School of Architecture, and he was told at that time, I guess he probably graduated in the 50s, maybe. Mid-50s, early 60s, I'm not sure, but he was told at that time, maybe 50s, I better take it back a little bit, that he should find another career because there would be no work for black architect. And so he went to Ghana and worked with Kwame Nkrumah. And many of the buildings that were built, the W.B. Du Bois Library and buildings in our Ivory Coast and so forth, were done by Max Bond. He came back to the U.S. and eventually... he built and designed the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, the Schomburg Library Edition, the Apollo Theater Edition, and some other amazing buildings on the Harvard Club in mid Manhattan. His last project was the 9/11 Museum and Memorial. His mentee, Peter Cook, did much of this and was leading the team because Max, they diagnosed cancer and much of this was Peter Cook and an architect named Rob Anderson. You know, just trying to get the leaders of the city to understand what this would do to this area.
And do leaders get this? Do you talk to them? Do they talk to you?
We talk to them, and we continue to talk. And there are some people who are, you know, work very hard with us. Elijah Cummings and Senator Nathaniel McFadden and Jack Young and so forth. We will be presenting before the city council in March, and we keep the dialogue open. And many of them get it. But I need more of them to get it.
How much would this cost?
This is a $76 million project, which we are doing in phases. And we've invested $14 million into this project already, because we had to buy the buildings. In some cases, institutions around the city were given the buildings, but we were given grant funds.
I think other museums can get bonds to build. One would think what this would do for the entire neighborhood rather than having a court system across the street.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, just the when you come, I'd like to think February 1st, but I know that the following week, starting at about February 7th, when you come North Avenue, all you're going to see is buses lined up on the street. And those buses, the majority of them are going to be from out of state. So we've shown that tourism can thrive over here. And so when those buses come up, just getting the leaders to understand that those buses aren't buses, they're jobs and opportunity. And when they come, they want to know, where else can we go? What else can we do? Is there a restaurant? And there's none. But taking that tourism that we have built and turning it into an economic engine right here in this community is just a no-brainer for me. So it just doesn't seem that I should be fighting as hard to get that message across. But
help you get that message across.
Thank you. I have the kids repeat the child's pledge to the ancestors. For my ancestors who gave me God's gift of life, I'm going to make the world a better place. And one line, that means that I'm going to know a slave ship when I see one, like the ones we call prisons and jails and penitentiaries where people are taken away in chains. That means that I'm going to know a slave trader when I see one, like the ones we call drug dealers. I'm going to be a leader of this world, a positive force in this world, for my ancestors who gave me God's gift of life. And therefore, this world will definitely be a better place simply because I'm in it.
You just heard the voice of Dr. Joanne Martin, co-founder, president, and CEO of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum, an amazing institution right here in Baltimore. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It is overwhelming, the amount of work that they do, how much effort she and her husband put into this before he passed away over 10 years ago. It's a history you feel as you walk through it, from the slave ships to slavery to the great things that African Americans have done to build not just the black community, but to build the entire country. It's an inspirational place, and you need to see it, you and your children. Some of the exhibits, I'll tell you, you have to make sure you want your kids to see them, especially around lynching, because you feel it, it's there, it's real. But this is our journey together here to bring to you here on the Mark Steiner Show, the Great Blacks and Wax Museum, and my conversation with Dr. Joanne Martin, CEO and co-founder. We have to break here, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Cece McDonald, the transgender woman and activist from Minneapolis. She was just released from a prison earlier this month after serving 19 months in a men's prison. You don't want to miss this conversation. Stay with us. On our way to break, it's more Slim Harpo. I'm a King Bee. We're down on this day in 1970. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Together.